Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
One of the things about the 21st century is that most organizations have created an always-on work context. It's burning people out and hurting performance rather than delivering productivity, innovation, and engagement. Collaborative work consumes 85% of employees' time and is drifting earlier into the morning, later into the night, and deeper into the weekend. The dilemma is that we all need to collaborate more to create effective organizations and vibrant careers for ourselves. But conventional wisdom on teamwork and collaboration has created too much of the wrong kind of collaboration, which hurts our performance, health, and overall well-being.
In Beyond Collaboration Overload, Babson professor Rob Cross solves this paradox by showing how top performers who thrive at work collaborate in a more purposeful way that makes them 18 to 24% more efficient than their peers. Good collaborators are distinguished by the efficiency and intentionality of their collaboration, not the size of their network or the length of their workday. Cross's framework provides relief from the definitive problem of our age: dysfunctional collaboration at the expense of our performance, health, and overall well-being. Rob Cross, the Edward A. Madden Professor of Global Leadership at Babson College and the co-founder and research director of the Connected Commons Business Consortium. Rob joins us this morning to talk about his latest book, Beyond Collaboration Overload: How to Work Smarter, Get Ahead, and Restore Your Well-Being. Rob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us how long it took you to write the book, and why did you feel it needed to be written?
This book is an accumulation of about 15 years of work. I was working with a lot of the organizations in the Connected Commons, and we were looking and using network analytics to see who are the people that are having the greatest impact in organizations and taking the least amount of time. And then went out and interviewed those to see what are those people doing that are buying time back about 18 to 24% compared to the average collaborators in the organizations. And so, of course, that took a good bit of time to get through all of that to understand on the margin what these people are doing. But I felt it was really critical because we could see over the past decade, as organizations have gone through different kinds of restructurings or have engaged in different forms of technology implementations, just the demands on people has grown beyond a point that's sustainable. And so it got me very interested in saying, how do we help people fight back and take control of the situation a little more?
So let's talk about the definition of collaboration overload. What do you mean by that term?
Rob, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh. Did you hear my question, Rob?
I didn't. Everything went blank for a second.
Let's try again. Rob, let's talk about what the definition of collaboration overload is. What does that term mean?
To me, it's the volume of demands coming at us in terms of time on the phone, on email, in meetings, virtual now typically, but some face-to-face occurring, and you know, other forms of IM, instantaneous interaction. And what we've seen is just the propensity for people to be in those collaborative interactions has risen like crazy over the past decade. You know, we're doing about 50% more work than we were 10 years ago, mainly because we're trying to collaborate in these contexts, and it's become overwhelming, you know, for an awful lot of people.
I guess, you know, trying to back up on that, because as you said, we're doing 50% more work than we used to, and most of that is collaboration. So if that's the case, you know, can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, how this impacts corporate performance? Can you give me maybe like an example or two of kind of this complete dysfunctional collaboration that you've seen?
Right. And so I very much am focused on the idea that collaboration is critical, right, to the success of organizations. The problem is a lot of the efforts that are taken to make organizations more nimble or fast are focused on taking layers out of the hierarchy, for example, or implementing various technologies that help people connect seamlessly with each other. All this is great, But when it's not, the volume of it's not managed, it results in significant overload around increasingly smaller sets of people. So what we can usually see is 3 to 5% of the people absorb 20 to 35% of the most of the collaborative demands in places. And so when they get overwhelmed, negative things can happen. Innovation starts to falter, or it tends to just follow the trajectory of those people in the center of the network. We see burnout happening to a great degree. It used to be that people would choose to leave an organization if they couldn't get connected enough, and now we're seeing more and more that it's people that get overwhelmed in different ways. And, you know, as we move into 2022, where people are projecting so many resignations coming, one of the fascinating things we're seeing in the consortia is the people that are most reticent to come back, you know, on some kind of full-time basis are those that are most thick in these networks. They've been the most supportive and kind of engaged with their colleagues, and they've just discovered a different way to live, you know, and not be kind of constantly always on. And so that represents yet another interesting challenge around what happens if you force those people back and they choose to leave. It's not just them walking out the door. It's that they take the network of connections with them that we're helping get things done in that context.
And one of the things that helped me understand where you were coming from was the sort of story you told about an executive named Scott who sort of performed so many different functions that through his efforts to collaborate, he became a bottleneck. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of times people look at these networks and they're thinking, gosh, you know, those people that have evolved into these bottleneck positions, they're control freaks, right? Or they're micromanagers, they're not letting things go. And I find that to be a pretty small proportion of the people that get stuck in this. So Scott was a classic servant-based leader. You know, he viewed leadership as helping others. And that's a great thing, you know, right up until it isn't. You know, right up until you have so many people that are conditioned to come to you that you get overwhelmed and can't keep up. And it starts to burn you out in different ways. So for Scott, as an example, the idea is not to help, right? But is to think about helping differently. Rather than jumping in and helping directly in a situation, it's actually helping people connect around you or helping build capability differently. So they're solving problems on their own. And this is one of my biggest surprises going through all this work in the analytics and over 600 interviews we did, was I was completely convinced the collaborative overload was out there. You know, the enemy was external. It was emails, time zones, nasty bosses, demanding clients. It was out of our control. And I came out the other end completely convinced that 50% or more of the problem is us. And it's ways that we tend to jump into collaborations, both in and out of work, when we're asked to do things, where we're triggered in certain ways that lead us to jump in a lot of times when we shouldn't. You know, for Scott, it was this idea that helping is leadership, right? For others, it's a need for accomplishment. Others, it's status. You know, for many people, it's fear. Just a fear of missing out or fear of what their colleagues think. And so kind of getting control of that turns out to be a really important thing, so you don't jump in small moments that then lead to overload 12, 18, you know, 20 weeks out.
So can you talk to us again about, you know, some of those pitfalls that people fall into? Scott had, you know, really conditioned people to always look to him for the go-ahead. What other types of examples do people tend to fall into?
Well, a lot of it happens slowly around people. You know, when you've been in an organization for some time and something you were good at 3 or 4 years ago, people just get conditioned to keep coming back to you on, and you get conditioned to answering because all these things seem small in the moment. What I've found is that this is a game where the people that are getting that 18 to 24% of their time back, they're not doing one big thing to get the time back. What they're doing is focusing much more intentionally on the small things. You know, it's a very easy activity we do with a lot of people is get them to look back in their calendars 4 months. You can't look back last week because we'll justify our involvement in everything, right? Mm-hmm. But if you get some space and distance to the sea of activity you're in, look back for not the big things, but look back for the, you know, routine informational requests you're getting that other people could be answering. Routine decisions you're getting pulled into that others could be better situated to handle for you, or you could change a policy or procedure to have an impact that doesn't require the decision to come to you. You're really categorizing things like that. And most people that are fairly senior in organizations, they'll find about 15-16% of their time in those small interactions, that if they categorize and then look for people that are 2 or 3 layers out in the network to make them go-to people on, has a really great effect of kind of decreasing the demands on the individual and pulling in
other talent that you want to get engaged, right? So it starts to build capability a little bit better in the network.
So in a sense, you're leveraging, what you're doing is you're choosing which things to be engaged in. And at some level, I think a lot of executives will find their egos get in the way of that, don't they? Because, I mean, does it mean I'm less important if I fully delegate? Is that a bit of a challenge that you've seen?
I think it's huge, yeah. I mean, what I can see as I go through these interviews, and when you asked kind of why did I decide to write the book, a part of it was just the analytics, you know, and seeing that people are getting crushed because we're not looking at the collaborative footprint of the asks we're making of people today. You know, we're just looking at ways to streamline decision hierarchies and assuming that's good. But then in all these stories, you know, I was getting to people that conventionally were very successful. And the first 10 or 15 minutes of the interview sounded great. But then suddenly it starts to unravel. And you start to hear people that have allowed all the other things in their lives to fall away as work has gotten more and more consuming. And they get to a point where their identity is completely tied up in work. In fact, one of the biggest things we find and talk about in Chapter 8, when we're looking at not just high performers, but people that are happier in their work, is the ones that maintain engagement in at least two and usually three groups outside of work. So these can be athletic pursuits, religious pursuits, poetry, music. They come from all walks of life. But they keep that dimensionality in their lives. Then they tend to be less reactive in those moments. And they tend to be the people that get, you know, less status. They tend to, you know, not get down to the minutiae of different interactions. And they tend not to drive interactions back to them over time. So there's one bit of advice I would have out of all of this. That's one really critical thing to people that are not just performing better, but are happier, you know, more broadly with all the demands coming at us today.
So as people are listening to this interview, they're looking at this topic and thinking of themselves, but some may be managers thinking of others that work, that they supervise. And if this was something, you know, if they were starting to see among their employees or their coworkers that they were getting overloaded, or as you said, you know, we're doing 50% more, you know, a lot of times people's first thing is like, well, I got to hire someone else, you know, like to take that stress off that person. Like, but that's not what you're saying. You're saying, let's learn how to work smarter.
Right.
And so right. I guess.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I could not emphasize that more. You know, the focus of the book is around how these people are buying time back that are about 18 to 24% more efficient than their peers. And it is on the margin. It's looking for all the small ways that you can pull time back by virtue of how you're choosing to engage, ways you're using the tools around you. But then what we see in the other side of the second half of the book is that a really critical question is how you then go use that time, right? What kinds of networks are you forming? How are you interacting with others in ways that creates their energy and draws things to you over time? Those are the biggest predictors of a successful person. So to me, it's not just about how do you buy time back, but it's also how do you teach people to engage in ways in this hyper-connected world that create scale and help them to do better over time.
You know, that one of the interesting questions that struck me is how hard is it to help people learn these new techniques? In other words, as you've gone out and talked to people about this, how hard is it to see people actually change?
I think it's fairly straightforward if they do two things. You know, one is there is this need to battle your own knee-jerk reactions.
Yeah.
In situations and to jump in. And, you know, most of us have had the experience of being asked to do something, you know, and this can be, you know, at work or outside of work, like a community thing or something like that. And you know, with every fiber of your being, that's not what you should get into. But we're very quick and in the next second to generate all these five ideas that we have to do this thing, right? We jump in and we do it, and then we're overwhelmed and wonder kind of why it happened. So that to me is one of the bigger things, is thinking very carefully about how and when we choose to jump in that people don't pay enough attention to. I think that's one of the harder parts, is we get so much identity from being quick to respond or being quick to jump in, that it becomes difficult. I think the second thing is you have to shape the context around you. So as an example, What we find is that it's often not email that kills people. It's the culture of use that people have allowed to persist around it, right? And so people are sending 8-paragraph emails where they're hiding what they want in the 7th paragraph, and people are all stuck reading that and CCing everybody else on it. I see leaders with teams just sit down and say, let's identify, you know, the different ways we're collaborating, email, meetings, IM, et cetera, and then let's just agree on each of those 5 things we're going to do that are good practices. So maybe we don't send email after 10 o'clock at night. If you have to do it, then you send it on a delay the next morning so that you're not stimulating that 10:01 response, 10:02, you know, always on culture. Very simple things like that where you get people to agree as a team around how you're collaborating, and then those norms tend to persist. You know what I mean? So you're kind of sculpting how the team is working. You're not just trying to take actions on your own.
One piece that I found unique as far as the approach in the book is recommending teaching others on how better to consume your time. It's like when you decide to eat healthy but don't tell your family and like they come to dinner. You know, like it's not going to be good unless we're all on the same page, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, one of the current fads right now is to block reflective time. Right. We know that if people typically will block chunks of 2-hour blocks in their calendar to be able to do thoughtful or strategic work, and it's a huge impact on productivity. What I was also finding as I went through all the interviews is the real heart of it was that people that were really good at this learned to manage to a rhythm of work that worked for them. You know, and so I would talk to one person and they would tell me, gosh, the first thing I do is email so I can get on to more thoughtful things through the day. And I would think, gosh, that must be a norm. And then I would talk to the next person and they would, you know, look, you say, are you crazy? Have you lost your mind? If I start with email, I'll never get off it. And they say, you know, I get up and I focus on the thoughtful or creative work early, and then I'll do email in 30-minute blocks through the day. I communicate to other people when I'm going to be doing this and when to expect a response from me. And they universally would say it's amazing how much the world adjusts to you if you're kind of communicating in that way and kind of giving people a sense of when and how to expect from you, rather than if you allow the system to dictate you and you start thinking, gosh, an IM came in, I have to respond immediately, and the concurrent costs that come with that. So I very much think it's the second step in this that's really critical, is not just taking actions that are improving your time, but then finding ways to propagate that through the teams you're a part of.
And how easy is that to have them adjust to you? We want to thank you. We've been speaking with Rob Cross. He is the author of Beyond Collaboration Overload, How to Work Smarter, Get Ahead, and Restore Your Well-Being. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. Do you love Mountain Money? Let us know. Leave us a review.